the Marines of religious orders. There's no life like it. And Beauvoir discovered a small stirring of understanding, of attraction even. This was a tough life, and only the tough made it. The few, the proud, the monks. Those of us who stay at Saint-Gilbert have been called here, but that means it's voluntary, and we have to be sure. So you test each new monk. We don't test him. The test is between himself and God, and there's no wrong answer, just the truth. He's given the door to God and the key to leave. Free choice? Asked Beauvoir, and saw the monk smile again. Might as well make use of it. Has anyone ever left? Lots. More leave than stay. And Brother Luke, he's been here almost a year now. When's his test over? When he decides it's over. When he asks to be taken out of the porter's room and comes to join the rest of us. Or he uses the key and leaves. Another heavy gourd landed in Beauvoir's basket. Frère Antoine moved down the row. He's in a sort of purgatory there, said the monk, searching among the huge leaves for more squash. Of his own making. It must be very painful. He seems paralyzed. By what? You tell me, Inspector, what generally paralyzes people? Beauvoir knew that answer. Fear. Frère Antoine nodded. Frère Luc is gifted. By far the best voice we have here, and that's saying something. But he's frozen with fear. Of what? Of everything. Of belonging and not belonging. He's afraid of the sun and afraid of shadows. He's afraid of creaks in the night and afraid of the morning dew. That's why I know Frère Mathieu wouldn't have chosen him to be the soloist. Because his voice, while beautiful, is full of fear. When that fear is replaced by faith, he'll be the soloist, but not before. Beauvoir thought about that as they inched down the row, his basket growing heavy with produce. But suppose the prior had chosen him. Suppose he decided most people wouldn't hear the fear or care. Maybe it even made the music more attractive, richer, more human. I don't know. But suppose Frère Mathieu had chosen Luc. How would you have felt? The monk took the straw hat from his head and wiped his brow. You think I'd care? Beauvoir met the stare. It really was like looking into a mirror. I think you'd care very deeply. Would you? If a man you admired, respected, revered even, passed you up in favour of someone else, what would you do? Is that how you felt about the prior? You revered him? I did. He was a great man. He saved the monastery. And if he wanted a monkey to sing solo, I'd happily plant bananas. Beauvoir found himself wanting to believe this man, perhaps because he wanted to believe he'd react the same way himself. But he had his doubts. And Jean-Guy Beauvoir also doubted this monk. Beneath that robe, beneath that ridiculous hat, wasn't the Son of God, but the Son of Man. And the Son of Man, Beauvoir knew, was capable of almost anything. If pushed, if betrayed, especially by a man he revered. Beauvoir knew that the root of all evil wasn't money. No, what created and drove evil was fear. Fear of not having enough money, enough food, enough land, enough power, enough security, enough love. Fear of not getting what you want or losing what you have. Beauvoir watched Brother Antoine collect hidden squash. What drove a healthy, smart young man to become a monk? Was it faith, or was it fear?
"Who's leading the choir now that the prior is gone?" Gamache asked.
They'd walked to the end of the garden and were wandering back. Their cheeks were red from the cold morning air. "I've asked Brother Antoine to take over the choir."
"The soloist? The one who challenged you last night?"
"The one who is by far the most accomplished musician. After Mathieu."
"You weren't tempted to take over?"
"I was tempted, and still am," said the abbot with a smile. "But I passed up that fruit. Antoine is the man for the job, not me."
"And yet he was one of the prior's men."
"What do you mean by that?" The abbot's smile faded.
Gamache cocked his head slightly and examined his companion. "I mean that this abbey, this order, is divided. The prior's men on one side, the abbot's men on the other."
"That's preposterous," the abbot snapped, then snapped back into place. But it was too late. Gamache had had a glimpse of what hid beneath the face. A serpent's tongue had lashed out and retreated just as quickly.
"It's the truth, mon père," said Gamache.
"You're mistaking dissent for dissension," said the abbot.
"I'm not. I do know the difference. What's happening here, and has probably been going on for quite a while, is far more than healthy disagreement. And you know it."
The two men had stopped walking and now stared at each other.
"I don't know what you mean, Monsieur Gamache. There's no such creature as an abbot's man or a prior's man. Mathieu and I worked together for decades. He looked after the music, I looked after their spiritual life."
"But weren't they one and the same? Frère Luc described a chance as both a bridge to God and God himself."
"Frère Luc is young and tends to simplify."
"Frère Luc is one of the prior's men."
The abbot bristled. "The chants are important, but only one aspect of our spiritual lives here at Saint-Gilbert."
"Does the split cut along those lines?" asked Gamache. His voice was calm but unrelenting. "Those for whom the music was paramount joined with the prior, those whose faith came first joined with you."
"There was no joining," said the abbot, his voice raised in exasperation. "Desperation, even," thought Gamache. "We're united. We can sometimes disagree, but that's all."
"And did you disagree about the direction of the abbey? Did you disagree about something as fundamental as the vow of silence?"
"I lifted that."
"Yes, but only after the prior was dead, and only to answer our questions, not to allow the monks to go into the world, do concerts, give interviews."
"The vow of silence will never be permanently lifted. Never."
"Do you think the second recording will go ahead?" Beauvoir asked.
Now, finally, he saw a reaction in Frère Antoine. A flash of anger, then suppressed. Like the root vegetables beneath their feet. Buried, but still growing.
"I have no idea. If the prior was alive, I'm sure it would have. The abbot was against it, of course, but Frère Mathieu would have won."
There was no uncertainty in the monk's voice, and Beauvoir finally had his button. It had taken him a while to find it. He could push and insult and harangue Frère Antoine all day, and he'd remain composed, good-humoured even. But mention the abbot? Kaboom!
"Why do you say, of course? Why would the abbot be against it?"
As long as he could keep pushing the abbot button, this monk would be off balance, and there was a better chance something unexpected would come out of that mouth.
"Because it wasn't under his control."
The monk leaned closer to Beauvoir. Jean-Guy felt the force of this monk's personality and his physical vitality. Here was a strong man in every way.
"Why are you a monk?" was really the question Beauvoir was longing to ask, but didn't. And he knew, deep down, why not. He, too, was afraid of the answer.
"Look, the abbot decides everything within these walls. In a monastic life, the abbot is all-powerful," said Frère Antoine, his hazel eyes focused on Beauvoir. "But he let something slip through his fingers, the music. In allowing the first recording, he let the music out into the world and lost control of it. The chants took on a life of their own. He spent the past year trying to undo all that, to contain them again." A malicious smile appeared on that handsome face. "But he can't. It's God's will, and he hates it. And he hated the prior. We all knew that."
"Why would he hate the prior? I thought they were friends."
"Because the prior was everything he isn't. Brilliant, gifted, passionate. The abbot's a dry old stick. A decent enough administrator, but no leader. He could quote the Bible front and back, in English and French and Latin. But with the Gregorian chants, the center of our life here? Well, some know it and some feel it. The abbot knows the chants. The prior felt them. And that made Frère Mathieu a far more powerful man in the monastery, and the abbot knew it.
But it must have always been like that. Why would the recording change anything?
and because as long as it was just us, they worked it out. Made a good team, in fact. But with the success of the recording, the power shifted. Suddenly the prior was getting recognition from the outside.
And with that came influence, said Beauvoir.
The abbot felt threatened. Then Frère Mathieu decided we should not only do another recording, but go out into the world, respond to the invitations. He felt strongly that those invitations came as much from God as from the people. It was, in essence, a literal calling. Suppose Moses had kept the tablets, or Jesus had remained a carpenter, privately communing with God. No, these gifts are meant to be shared. The prior wanted to share them, but the abbot didn't. The words tumbled over themselves to leave Frère Antoine's body. He couldn't condemn Dom Philippe fast enough. The prior wanted the vow of silence lifted, so that we could go into the world.
And the abbot refused, said Beauvoir. Did he have much support?
Some of the brothers were loyal to him, more out of habit than anything, habit and training. We're taught to always bend our will to the abbot.
Then why didn't you?
Because Dom Philippe would have destroyed Saint-Gilbert, taken it back to the Dark Ages. He wanted nothing to change, but it was too late. The recording changed everything. It was a gift of God. But the abbot refused to see it that way. He said the recording was like the serpent in the garden, trying to lure us away, seduce us with promises of power and money.
Maybe he was right, Beauvoir suggested, and was rewarded with a look of fury.
He's a frightened old man clinging to the past. Frère Antoine was leaning toward Beauvoir, practically spitting the words. Then he paused, and a perplexed look crossed his face. The monk cocked his head to one side. Beauvoir also paused to listen. Something was coming. Armand Gamache looked into the sky. Something was coming. He and the abbot had been discussing the garden. He wanted to bring the interview back to a more conversational tone. It was like fishing. Reel in, let go. Reel in, let go. Give the suspect the impression of freedom, that they were off the hook. Then reel them in again. It was exhausting for everyone, but mostly Gamache knew for whoever was on the hook and writhing. The abbot had clearly interpreted this shift of tone and subject as Gamache relenting.
"Why do you think Dom Clément built this garden?" the chief had asked.
"What do people who live close together value most?" Gamache thought about that. Was it companionship, peace and quiet, tolerance?
"Privacy?"
the abbot nodded. "Oui, c'est ça. Dom Clément gave himself the one thing no one else in Saint-Gilbert had, privacy."
"Another division," said Gamache, and the abbot looked at him.
Dom Philippe had felt the slight tug on the line and realized what he'd taken for freedom wasn't that at all. Gamache considered what the abbot had just said. Maybe their legendary treasure wasn't a thing, but nothing. An empty room no one knew about, and a lock. Privacy. And with privacy, of course, came something else. Safety. That was, Gamache knew, what people valued most of all. Then he heard it. He scanned the clear blue sky. Nothing. But something was there, and it was getting closer. A roar shattered the peace. It seemed to be coming from all around them, as though the sky had opened its mouth and was shrieking at them. All the mushroom monks and Beauvoir looked up. Then, as a man, they ducked. Gamache ducked and pulled Dom Philippe down with him. The plane zoomed overhead and was gone in an instant. But Gamache heard it bank and turn back. Both men stood stock still, staring into the sky, Gamache still clasping the abbot's robes.
"It's coming back," Dom Philippe shouted.
"Shit,"
yelled Beauvoir above the straining engines.
"Christ," yelled Frère Antoine.
Beauvoir stared into the sky. It was maddening, only being able to see the patch of blue directly over their heads. They could hear the plane banking, straining, approaching, but couldn't see it. And then it was upon them again, even lower this time, apparently heading straight for the bell tower.
"Oh, shit," said Frère Antoine.
Dom Philippe grabbed at Gamache's jacket, and the two men ducked again.
"Damn!"
Gamache heard the abbot, even above the straining engines.
"They almost hit the monastery," screamed Dom Philippe. "It's the press. I'd hoped we'd have more time."
Beauvoir slowly stood, but remained alert, listening. The sound grew momentarily louder, disappeared, then there was a mighty splash.
"Christ," said Beauvoir.
"Merde," said Frère Antoine.
The monks and Beauvoir ran to the door, back into the monastery, their floppy hats abandoned in the garden.
"Damn," thought Gamache, leaving the garden with the abbot. He'd scanned the plain as it zoomed over the garden, within feet, it seemed, of their heads. At the last moment it banked to miss the bell tower. In that moment, before it disappeared again, he'd seen an insignia on the door of the plain. They joined the parade of monks walking quickly down the corridors, picking up more monks and more speed as they progressed through the halls, across the Blessed Chapel, and into the final corridor. Gamache could see Beauvoir just ahead, walking rapidly beside Frère Antoine. Young Frère Luc stood in front of the locked door, holding the wrought-iron key in his hand. He stared at them. Gamache, alone among the men, knew exactly what was on the other side of that door. He'd recognized the insignia on the plane. It wasn't the press, nor was it curiosity seekers come to gawk at the famous monastery, made infamous by a terrible crime. No, this was another creature entirely, smelling blood.
Chapter 17. At a nod from the abbot, Frère Luc put the key in the lock. It turned easily, and the door opened, letting in a breeze of pine-scented air and sunshine, and the sound of a float plane taxiing to the dock. The monks clustered around the open door. Then the abbot stepped forward.
"I'll ask them to leave," he said, his voice determined.
"Perhaps I should come along," said Gamache.
Dom Philippe studied the chief, then nodded. Beauvoir made to join them, but was stopped by a subtle wave of Gamache's hand.
"It would be better if you stayed here."
"What is it?" Beauvoir asked, seeing the look on the chief's face.
"I'm not really sure."
Gamache turned back to the abbot and motioned toward the wharf.
"Shall we?"
The plane had almost reached the dock. The pilot cut power, the prop slowed, and the plane, on its pontoons, drifted the last few feet to the dock. Gamache and the abbot grabbed the struts and steadied the plane. Then the chief reached toward the ropes dangling in the cold lake.
"I wouldn't bother," said the abbot. "They won't be staying long."
The chief turned, the wet line in his hand.
"I think they might."
"You forget who's in charge here."
Gamache knelt and made a couple of quick knots, securing the float plane to the dock. Then he stood back up.
"I don't forget. It's just that I think I know who's in the plane. It's not the press, you know."
"No?"
"I wasn't completely sure I'd seen it right when the plane flew over. That's why I wanted to come with you."
The chief pointed to the crest on the door. It showed four fleurs-de-lis, and above them was a stenciled MJQ.
"MJQ?" asked the abbot.
The small door opened.
"A Ministère de la Justice du Québec," said Gamache,
and stepped forward, offering his hand to steady the visitor as he squeezed out of the float plane. The chief inspector's offer was either not noticed or ignored. A fine black leather shoe appeared, then a second, and a man stood for a moment on the pontoon, then strolled casually onto the deck, as though into an opera house or an art gallery. He looked around, taking in his surroundings.
Not an explorer landed in a new world, but a conqueror. He was in late middle age, 60 perhaps. His hair was grey, his face was clean-shaven, handsome and assured. No weakness there. Neither was it the face of a bully. He appeared to be completely at home, composed and comfortable. While most men would look slightly ridiculous, arriving in the wilderness in a fine suit and tie, this man made it seem perfectly natural, even enviable. And Gamache suspected, if the visitor stayed long enough, the monks would eventually be in suits and ties themselves, and thanking the visitor. He had that effect on people, not adjusting to the world, but having the world adjust to him, which it did, with a few but notable exceptions. The man stood on the dock and looked around, his eyes sweeping over Gamache, over and through and by him, and came to rest on the abbot. "Adam Philippe?" The abbot bowed, but didn't take his blue eyes off the stranger. "My name is Sylvain Franceur." The man put out his hand. "I'm the chief superintendent of the Sûreté du Québec." The abbot's eyes shifted for a moment to Gamache, then back again. Armand Gamache knew his own expression was relaxed, attentive, respectful. But had Dom Philippe, so good at neumes, read the tiny lines on the chief inspector's face and seen how Gamache really felt? "What the fuck is this about?" whispered Beauvoir, as they walked back down the corridor a few feet behind the abbot and Chief Superintendent Franceur. Gamache shot Beauvoir a warning, not a slight visual reprimand, but a club to the head. "Shut up," said the stern expression. "Hold your tongue now if you've never held it before." Beauvoir shut up, but that didn't stop him from watching and listening. As they progressed, they walked through the clouds of conversation created by the two men ahead. "A terrible shame, mon père," the chief superintendent was saying. "The prior's death is a national tragedy. I can assure you, though, that we'll solve this quickly, and you'll have your privacy to grieve. I've ordered my people to keep Frère Mathieu's death quiet for as long as possible." Chief Inspector Gamache said that wouldn't be possible. "And he was quite correct, of course. He couldn't do it. I have the highest respect for Monsieur Gamache, but his powers are limited." "And yours are not?" asked the abbot. Beauvoir smiled and wondered if the abbot knew who he was dealing with. Superintendent Franceur laughed. It was relaxed and good humours. "By your measurement, Dom Philippe, my powers are pretty puny, but measured in mortal terms they're substantial, and are at your disposal." "Merci, mon fils. I'm most grateful." Beauvoir turned a disgusted face to Gamache and opened his mouth, but shut it again upon seeing the chief's expression. It wasn't angry, it wasn't even upset. Chief Inspector Gamache was puzzled, as though trying to work out some complex mathematical formula that didn't add up. Beauvoir had a question of his own. "What the fuck is this about?" "Can I say it now?" Beauvoir leaned against the closed door. "No need," said the chief, taking a chair in the prior's cramped office. "I know the question, but not the answer." "Like jeopardy," said Beauvoir, crossing his arms over his chest and continuing to lean against the door, a human deadbolt. "I'll take what the fuck for 200, Alex." Gamache laughed. "It is puzzling," he admitted. And, thought Beauvoir, it might also be jeopardy. They'd last seen Superintendent Franceur walking through the Blessed Chapel, deep in conversation with the abbot. The homicide agent and the monks had been dismissed, but had, for a moment, stood together watching these two men progress through the church and down the long corridor toward the abbot's offices. A Franceur's head, with its distinguished grey hair, was bent toward the abbot's shaved head. Two extremes, one finely dressed, the other in austere robes, one forceful, the other a study in humility. But both in charge, apparently. Beauvoir wondered if the two men would form an alliance or start another war. He looked at Gamache, who'd put his reading glasses on and was making notes. And where did this leave the chief? The appearance of Sylvain Franceur seemed to have left Gamache perplexed, but unconcerned. Beauvoir hoped he genuinely was, and there was no need to worry. But it was too late for that. Worry had taken root in Beauvoir's belly. An old and familiar ache. Gamache looked up and met Beauvoir's eyes. The chief smiled reassuringly. "It's no use speculating, Jean-Guy. We'll know why Superintendent Franceur's here soon enough." They spent the next half hour discussing their conversations that morning, Beauvoir with Frère Antoine and Gamache with the abbot. "So the abbot made Frère Antoine the new choir director?" Beauvoir's surprise was obvious. "Perhaps it made the abbot look too good, and Frère Antoine wouldn't want that."
Yeah, maybe. But do you think that's why the abbot did it?
What do you mean?
Gamache leaned forward. He could have appointed anyone, could have taken the job himself. But maybe he gave it to Frère Antoine just to screw with the prior's men. A mindfuck. Do the opposite of what they expect. Prove he's above their stupid little fights by making Frère Antoine the choir director. Maybe the abbot wanted to show he's better than them. It's a smart move, if you think about it. Gamache thought about it. He thought about the 24 monks, messing with each other's minds, trying to keep each other off balance. Is that what was going on here, perhaps for years? A form of psychological terrorism? Subtle, invisible. A glance, a smile, a turned back. In a silent order, a single word, a sound, could be devastating. A tisk, a sniff, a chuckle. Had the gentle abbot perfected those weapons? Promoting Frère Antoine was the right thing to do. He was the best musician, a clear successor to the prior as choirmaster. But did the abbot do it for the wrong reason? To screw with the prior's men? And the vow of silence? Had the abbot fought to keep it because of the spiritual significance to the community? Or again, to screw with the prior? To deny the prior what he most wanted? And why was the prior so determined to lift a vow in place for nearly 1,000 years? Was it for the good of the order, or the good of the prior?
What are you thinking? Asked Beauvoir. A phrase popped into my mind, and I was just trying to remember where it came from.
Is it poetry? Asked Beauvoir a little nervously. It didn't take much for the chief to start quoting some unintelligible poem.
As a matter of fact, I was thinking of an epic work by Homer.
Gamache opened his mouth as though to start reciting, then laughed at the distress on Beauvoir's face.
No, it's just a line. To do the right deed for the wrong reason.
Beauvoir thought about that. I wonder if the opposite is ever true.
What do you mean?
Well, can you do the wrong thing for the right reason? Gamache took off his glasses.
Go on.
He listened closely, his calm brown eyes not straying from his inspector. Like murder, said Beauvoir. Killing someone is wrong, but can the reason ever be right?
A justifiable homicide, said Gamache. It's a defense, but a shaky one.
Do you think this might be justifiable?
Why do you ask?
Beauvoir thought for a moment. Something went wrong here. The monastery was falling apart, imploding. Suppose it was the prior's fault.
So he was killed to save the rest of the community? Asked Gamache.
Maybe. They both knew it was a hideous argument, one made by many a madman, that the killing was for the greater good. But was it ever true? Gamache had wondered about that himself. Suppose the prior was that one bad apple, spreading dissent, rotting this peaceful community, one monk at a time. A people killed in war all the time. If there was a quiet but devastating war going on at Saint-Gilbert, maybe one of the monks convinced himself this was the only way to end it, before the entire abbey was rotted out from the inside. Banishing the prior wouldn't be possible. He'd done nothing overtly wrong. That was the thing with the bad apple. It was insidious, slow. It looked just fine from the outside, until the rot spread, and by then it was too late.
Maybe, said Gamache, but maybe the bad apple is still here.
The murderer?
Or maybe it was someone whispering in the murderer's ear.
On that thought he leaned back.
Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest?
You think that's what was said? Asked Beauvoir. Seems a little flowery to me. I'd probably say, fucking die already. Gamache laughed.
You should write to Hallmark with that one.
Not a bad idea. There are lots of people I'd send it to.
Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest?
Gamache repeated.
It's what Henry II said about Thomas a Becket.
Is that supposed to mean something to me?
Gamache grinned. Hang in there, young man. This story ends in murder.
Better.
This was almost 900 years ago, the chief continued, in England.
I'm already asleep.
King Henry promoted his good friend Thomas to be archbishop, thinking that would give him control of the church, but it backfired.
Despite himself, Beauvoir leaned forward.
The king was worried that there was too much crime in England. He wanted to crack down on it.
As Gamache spoke, Beauvoir nodded, sympathizing with the king.
But he felt all his efforts were undermined by the church, since it was pretty lenient with criminals.
So this king, Henry, said Gamache, Henry, he sees his chance and makes his friend Thomas an archbishop. What went wrong?
Well, to begin with, Thomas didn't want the job. He even wrote to Henry saying that if he took the job, their friendship would turn to hate.
And he was right. Gamache nodded.
The king passed a law saying that anyone found guilty in a church court would be punished by the royal court. Thomas refused to sign it.
So he was killed?
Not immediately. It took 6 years, the animosity growing every day. Then one day, King Henry muttered those words, and four knights took it to be an order.
What happened?
They killed the archbishop, in Canterbury Cathedral. Murder in the cathedral.
Will no one, Beauvoir struggled to remember the quote,
rid me of this troublesome priest?
Gamache finished it.
You think the abbot said something like that, and someone took it as an order?
Maybe.
In a place like this, the abbot might not even need to speak. A look would be enough. A raised brow, a grimace.
What happened after the archbishop was killed?
He was sainted.
Beauvoir laughed. That must have pissed off the king.
Gamache smiled. Henry spent the rest of his life regretting the murder, and said he'd never meant for that to happen.
Do you think that's true?
I think it was easy to say, after the fact.
So you think the abbot here might have said something like that, and one of his monks killed the prior?
It's possible.
And knowing what happened, Dom Philippe turns around and does the unexpected. He appoints one of the prior's men to lead the choir.
Beauvoir was picking his way through it.
Guilty mind?
Penance? Amends?
Gamache frowned, thinking.
Could be.
It was so difficult to know why these monks did anything, thought Gamache. They were so different from anyone he'd ever met or investigated. But finally, he had to tell himself they were just men, with the same motives as anyone else, only theirs were hidden behind black robes and angelic voices, and silence.
The abbot denies there's a split, said Gamache, leaning back in his chair and lacing his fingers together.
Wow! Beauvoir shook his head. The things these monks can believe without evidence. They give them proof of something, and they don't believe it. The split's so obvious. Half want to record more chants, half don't. Half want the vow of silence lifted, half don't.
I'm not sure it's half and half, said Gamache. I suspect the balance had shifted in the prior's favour.
And that's why he was killed?
I think it's possible.
Beauvoir considered what the chief had said. So the abbot's kind of screwed. Frère Antoine called him a frightened old man. Do you think he killed Frère Mathieu?
I honestly don't know. But if Dom Philippe's filled with fear, he isn't the only one, said Gamache. I think most of them are.
Because of the murder?
No. I'm not sure these men are really afraid of death. I think they're afraid of life. But here, in Saint-Gilbert, they finally found where they belonged.
Beauvoir thought of the field of giant mushrooms with the floppy hats, and how he'd felt the odd one out, in his pressed slacks and merino wool sweater.
So if they finally found where they belong, what are they afraid of?
Losing it, said the chief.
They'd been in purgatory. Many have probably been in hell. And once you've been there, you sure don't want to go back.
Gamache paused, and the two men held each other's eyes. Beauvoir could see the deep scar by the chief's temple, and he could feel the ache gnawing his own gut. He saw the bottle of tiny pills he kept hidden in his apartment, just in case.
Yes, thought Beauvoir,
You sure don't want to slip back into hell." The chief leaned forward, put on his glasses, and unrolled a large cylinder of paper on the desk. Beauvoir watched Gamache, but saw something else. Superintendent Francois stepping from the plane that had descended so quickly from the sky. The chief had offered his hand, but Francois had turned his back on Gamache for all to see, for Beauvoir to see. The sick feeling sat like a fist in Beauvoir's stomach. It had found a home there, was settling in and growing.
"The abbot gave us a plan of the monastery."
Gamache stood and leaned over the desk. Beauvoir joined him. The drawing looked exactly as Beauvoir imagined the abbey in his mind after walking the halls for 24 hours, shaped like a cross, with the chapel in the very centre and the bell tower above that.
"Here's the chapter house," said Gamache.
The room was shown on the drawing, attached to the side of the chapel. There was no attempt to hide it in the design, but in real life it was hidden, behind the plaque to Saint-Gilbert. The abbot's garden was also on the plan, plain to see in ink, but not in real life. It too was hidden, but not secret.
"Are there any other hidden rooms?" Beauvoir asked. "The abbot doesn't know of any, but he admits there are rumours of secret rooms and something else."
"What?" asked Beauvoir.
"Well, it's almost embarrassing to say," admitted Gamache, taking off his glasses and looking at Beauvoir.
"I would have thought a man caught in his pyjamas on a church altar would have a high tolerance for embarrassment."
"You make a good point," the chief smiled. "Treasure."
"Treasure? Are you kidding? The abbot says there's a treasure hidden here?"
"He doesn't say it," said Gamache. "He says those are the rumours."
"Have they looked?"
"None officially. I think monks aren't supposed to care about such things."
"But men do," said Beauvoir, looking back down at the plan. An old abbey with a hidden treasure, thought Beauvoir. It was too ridiculous. No wonder the chief was embarrassed to say it. But while he ridiculed the idea, Beauvoir's eyes were bright as he scanned the drawing. What child, boy or girl, hadn't dreamed of hidden treasure? Hadn't lapped up stories of derring-do, of galleons and pirates, and fleeing princes and princesses burying something precious? Or better yet, finding something precious? As ridiculous and far-fetched as a hidden room with treasure almost certainly was, Beauvoir couldn't help but be sucked into the fantasy. In an instant he found himself wondering what the treasure could be. The riches of the medieval church? Chalices, paintings, coins, priceless jewels brought back by crusaders? Then Jean-Guy imagined finding it. Not for the sake of the fortune, or at least not entirely for that, but for the fun of finding it. Instantly he saw himself telling Annie. He could see her watching him, listening, hanging on his every word, reacting to each twist in the tale, her face expressive as he told her about the search, gasping, laughing. They'd talk about it for the rest of their lives, tell their children and grandchildren about the time Grandpa found the treasure and returned it to the church.
"So," said Gamache, rolling the plan back up, "I can leave this with you?" He handed it to Beauvoir. "I'll split everything with you, patron, 50-50. "I already have my treasure, thank you very much," said Gamache. "I don't think a bag of chocolate-covered blueberries could be considered a treasure." "No?" asked Gamache. "To each his own." A deep bell started ringing. Not a joyous celebration, but a solemn toll. "Again?" said Beauvoir. "Can't I just stay here?" "Of course you can." Gamache took from his breast pocket the aerarium the abbot's secretary had given him and examined it. Then he looked at his watch. 11 a.m. mass," he said, and walked toward the closed door. "Is it only 11? Feels like bedtime." For a place that ran like clockwork, time seemed to stand still. Beauvoir opened the door for the chief, and after the smallest hesitation and a whispered curse, he followed him down the corridor and back into the blessed chapel. Gamache slipped into the pew, Beauvoir beside him. They sat quietly, waiting for the service to begin.
Again, the chief marveled at the light falling through the high windows, split into all different colors. It spilled onto the altar and the benches and seemed to dance there, waiting happily for the company of the monks. The chief glanced around the now familiar space. It felt as though he'd been there a very long time, and it came as a surprise he and Beauvoir hadn't yet spent a full day at Saint-Gilbert-entre-les-Loups. The Blessed Chapel, Gamache now knew, was built to honour a saint so dull the church couldn't find some equally dull complaint to let him patronise. Few prayed to Saint-Gilbert. And yet, in his excruciatingly long life, Gilbert had done one spectacular thing. He'd stood up to a king. He defended his archbishop. Thomas had been killed, but Gilbert had stood up to tyranny and survived. Gamache remembered joking with the abbot that maybe Gilbert could become the patron saint of fretters, since his monastery had such strong defences and locked doors, and so many places to hide. But maybe he'd been wrong, done Gilbert a disservice. He might have fretted, but Gilbert had finally found more courage than anyone else. Sitting quietly in the refracted light, Gamache wondered if he'd have the same courage. He spent a moment thinking about the new visitor and praying to Saint-Gilbert. As the last note of the solemn bell resonated, the monks entered. They appeared in single file, singing. White hoods hid their faces. Hands were buried up to the elbows in their loose black sleeves. The singing grew as more voices entered the Blessed Chapel until the empty space was filled with the plain chant and the light. And then someone else entered. Chief Superintendent Francois bobbed, crossed himself, then, despite all sorts of empty pews, he slipped into the one directly in front of Gamache and Beauvoir, obscuring their view. And once again, the chief inspector tilted his head slightly to the side, hoping to see more clearly the monks, but also the motives of the man in front of him, who dropped so precipitously from the skies with a purpose. As Beauvoir huffed and snorted beside him, Gamache closed his eyes and listened to the beautiful music, and thought about tyranny and murder, and whether it was ever right to kill one for the sake of the many. Chapter 18. Are you lost? Beauvoir spun around to confront the voice. I only ask because it's unusual to find someone here. A monk was standing in the thick forest, a few feet from Beauvoir. It was as though he'd suddenly materialized. Beauvoir recognized him. It was the monk from the chocolate factory, who'd been covered in dribbled dark chocolate the last time Beauvoir had seen him. Now he had on a clean cassock and was carrying a basket, like Little Red Riding Hood. Entre les loups, thought Beauvoir, among the wolves. No, I'm not lost, he said, and tried to quickly roll up the plan of Saint-Gilbert. But it was way too late for that. The monk was standing very still, just watching. It made Beauvoir feel foolish and wary. It was disconcerting to be around people who were so still and so quiet, and so stealthy. Can I help you with something? Asked the monk. I was just... Beauvoir waved the semi-rolled plan. Looking? He smiled. Beauvoir half expected to see long canine teeth, but instead it was a small, almost tentative grin. I'm looking too, said the monk, but probably not for the same thing. It was the kind of vaguely patronizing remark Beauvoir expected from a religieux. He was probably on some spiritual quest, so much more worthy than whatever the bumbling human in front of him might be about. The monk was strolling the forest, looking for inspiration, or salvation, or God, praying or meditating, while Beauvoir was looking for treasure. Ah, said the monk, found some. He stooped, then stood back up and offered his palm to Beauvoir. Tiny wild blueberries rolled together in the valley of the man's hand. They're perfect, said the monk. Beauvoir looked at them. They looked like every other wild blueberry he'd ever seen. Please. The monk moved his palm closer, and Beauvoir took a single tiny berry. It was like trying to pick up an atom. He popped it in his mouth, and there was an immediate wallop of flavor, far out of proportion to the portion. It tasted, not surprisingly, of blueberry. But it also tasted like autumn in Quebec, sweet and musky. This monk was right. It really was perfect. He took another, as did the monk. The two men stood in the shadow of the tall wall of the abbot's garden, eating berries. Just a few feet away, over the wall, was a manicured garden, beautifully planted and cared for, with lawns and flower beds, clipped bushes and benches. But here, on this side of the wall, there were tiny, perfect blueberries. There was also a tangle of undergrowth, so thick it had scratched Beauvoir's legs through his slacks as he'd ploughed his way through the thickets. He'd been following the line of the monastery on foot and on paper. He'd borrowed rubber boots from the monks and found himself stepping into muck, climbing over downed trees and scrambling over rocks, trying to figure out if the lines on the page matched the walls of the actual abbey. "How'd you sneak up on me?"
"Sneak?"
the monk laughed. "I'm just doing my rounds. There's a path over there. Why didn't you take that?" "Well, I would have had I known," said Beauvoir, not altogether sure they were talking about the same thing. He'd worked long enough with Chief Inspector Gamache to smell an allegory. "My name's Bernard," said the monk, sticking out his purple-stained hand. "Beauvoir." The handshake surprised Beauvoir. He'd expected a soft, doughy hand, but instead it was firm and assured, the skin far tougher than his own.
"Wow, look at that."
Frère Bernard stooped again and stayed there, kneeling and plucking berries. Beauvoir knelt as well and peered at the ground. Slowly, instead of seeing just a riot of twigs and moss and dried leaves, he began to see what Frère Bernard had been looking for. Not salvation, but the tiniest of wild fruit.
"My God," laughed Bernard, "it's the motherlode. I've been along that path every fall for years and never knew this was here."
"You can't be suggesting it's sometimes good to wander from the path." Beauvoir was pleased with himself. He could give good allegory, too. The monk laughed again. "Touché." They spent the next few minutes crawling around the undergrowth, collecting blueberries.
"Well," said Frère Bernard at last, standing and stretching and brushing twigs from his cassock, "this must be a record."
He looked at his basket, piled high with berries.
"You're my good luck charm. Merci."
Beauvoir felt quite pleased with himself.
"Now," said Bernard, pointing to a couple of flat rocks, "it's my turn to help you."
Beauvoir hesitated. He'd stuck the plan of the monastery in a bush, where it would be safe while they picked the berries. Now he looked over at it. Bernard followed his gaze, but said nothing. Beauvoir retrieved the plan, and the two men sat facing each other on the rocks.
"What are you looking for?" asked the monk.
Still Beauvoir hesitated, then made up his mind and unrolled the plan. Frère Bernard lowered his gaze from Beauvoir's face to the vellum. His eyes widened slightly.
"Dom Clément's plan of the monastery," he said. "We'd heard he'd made one. He was a famous architect in his day, you know. Then he joined the Gilbertine and disappeared along with the other 23 monks. No one knew where they went. No one much cared, actually. The Gilbertine were never a rich or powerful order, just the opposite. So when the monastery in France was abandoned, everyone just assumed the order had disbanded or died out."
"But they hadn't," said Beauvoir, also staring at the plan.
"No, they came here. Might as well have been the moon in those days."
"Why'd they come?"
"They were afraid of the Inquisition."
"But if they were so poor and marginal, why were they afraid?"
"Why is anyone afraid? Most of the time it's all in their heads. Has nothing to do with reality. I imagine the Inquisition couldn't have cared less about the Gilbertine, but they took off anyway, just in case. That could be our motto, just in case. Existo paratus."
"You've never seen this before?" Beauvoir pointed to the drawing. Frère Bernard shook his head. He seemed lost in the lines on the page.
"It's fascinating," said the monk, leaning closer, seeing Dom Clément's actual plan. "I wonder if this was made before or after Saint-Gilbert was built."
"Would it matter?"
"Maybe not. But one would be the ideal, the other would be the reality. If it was made after, then this shows what's really here, not what they might have wanted, then changed their minds."
"You know the monastery," said Beauvoir. "What do you think?" For a few minutes, Frère Bernard bowed his head over the vellum, sometimes tracing the ink with his blueberry finger. He gave a few grunts, hummed a bit, shook his head, then backed up his finger to follow another line, another corridor. Finally, he looked up and met Beauvoir's eyes. "There's something wrong with this drawing." Beauvoir felt a thrill, a frisson. "What?" "The scale's off. You see, here and here, the vegetable garden and the place for the animals." "Right. They're shown as the same size as the abbot's garden, but they're not. In reality, they're at least twice the size." It was true. Beauvoir remembered picking the squash that morning with Frère Antoine. The vegetable garden had been huge. But the abbot's garden, the murder scene, was much smaller. "But how do you know?" asked Beauvoir. "Have you ever been in the abbot's garden?" He glanced to the tall wall. "Never, but I've been around it, looking for berries. I've also been around the other gardens. This plan," he looked back down, "is wrong." "So what does that mean?" asked Beauvoir. "Why would Dom Clément do that?" Bernard considered, then shook his head. "Hard to say. The church had a way of exaggerating things. If you see some of the old paintings, the baby Jesus looks about 10 years old when he was born, and old maps of cities show cathedrals much bigger than they actually were, dominating their surroundings." "So you think Dom Clément exaggerated the size of the abbot's garden? But why?" Again the monk shook his head. "Vanity, maybe? To make the drawing look more to scale? Church architecture has little tolerance for anything unusual, out of balance." "This looks better on paper." Again the monk gestured toward the drawing, "than the real thing, though the real thing functions better in reality." Again, Beauvoir was taken by the clash of perception and reality in this monastery, and the choice to reflect what looked good rather than what was truthful. Frère Bernard continued to study the drawing. "If Dom Clément had drawn it exactly as it is, the monastery wouldn't look like a crucifix anymore. It would look like a bird, two big wings and a shorter body." "So he cheated?" "I suppose that's one way of putting it." "Could he have cheated in other areas of the plan?" asked Beauvoir, though he knew the answer to that. When someone deceived once, they'd do it again. "I suppose." The monk looked as though one of the angels had fallen. "But I can't see anything else wrong. Why does it matter?"
"It might not." Beauvoir rolled the plan back up. "You asked what I was looking for. I'm looking for a hidden room."
"Like the chapter house?"
"We know about that one. I'm looking for another."
"So there is one?"
"We don't know. We've just heard rumors, and obviously you have too." For the first time in their conversation, Beauvoir sensed a hesitation in the monk, as though a door had slowly swung shut, as though Frère Bernard had his own hidden room. Of course, everyone had one, and it was his job and the chief's to find those too. Unfortunately for them, those rooms almost never hid treasure. What they invariably found were mountains of crap. "If there really is a secret room in the monastery, you need to tell me," Beauvoir pressed.
"I don't know of any."
"But you've heard rumors."
"There are always rumors. I'd heard that one the first day I arrived."
"For a silent order, you seem to do a lot of talking." Bernard smiled.
"We're not completely silent, you know. We're allowed to talk at certain times of the day."
"And one of the things you talk about is secret rooms?"
"If you're only allowed a few minutes' conversation a day, what do you think you talk about? The weather? Politics?
Secrets?"
Frère Bernard smiled. "Sometimes a divine mystery, and sometimes just mysteries, like hidden rooms and treasure." He gave Beauvoir a knowing look, a sharp look. This monk thought Beauvoir might be calm and even gentle, but he was no fool.
"Do you think they exist? A room and some treasure lugged here by Dom Clément and the other monks centuries ago?"
Frère Bernard shook his head. "It's fun to think about. Passes the time on cold winter nights. But no one really believes it exists. Someone would have found it ages ago. The abbey's been renovated, updated, repaired. If there was a secret room, we'd have found it."
"Maybe someone did."
Beauvoir stood.
"So, how often are you allowed to leave?"
The monk laughed. "It's not a prison, you know." But even Frère Bernard had to admit, from that angle, Saint-Gilbert sure looked like one. "We leave whenever we want, though we don't go far. Walks, mostly. We look for berries and firewood. We fish. In the winter we play hockey on the ice. Frère Antoine organizes that." Beauvoir felt again that vertigo. Frère Antoine played hockey. Was probably the captain and the centre. The same position Beauvoir played. "In the summer, some of us jog and do Tai Chi. You're welcome to join us after vigils."
"Is that the early morning service?"
5 a.m., he smiled. "Your chief was there this morning." Beauvoir was about to say something sharp, to shut down any ridiculing of Gamache, when he saw that Frère Bernard seemed simply amused, not mocking.
"Yes, he mentioned it to me," said Beauvoir.
"We talked later that morning, you know."
"Oh, really?"
But Beauvoir knew perfectly well it was Frère Bernard the chief had spoken to that morning in the showers, and that they then collected eggs together. Brother Bernard had told the chief about the rift in the community. In fact, Chief Inspector Gamache had the impression the monk had sought him out specifically to tell him that. And only then did it occur to Beauvoir to wonder if the same thing was happening here. Had this monk simply been out collecting blueberries and stumbled upon him? Or was this no accident? Had Frère Bernard seen Beauvoir leave with the scroll and followed him?
"Your chief's a good listener," said the monk. "He'd fit in well here."
"He does look good in a robe," said Beauvoir. Frère Bernard laughed. "I was afraid to say it." The monk looked at Beauvoir, examining the younger man. "I think you'd also enjoy it here."
"Enjoy?" thought Beauvoir. "Enjoy? Does anyone actually enjoy it here?" He'd presumed they tolerated it, like a hair shirt. It never occurred to him living in Saint-Gilbert entre les loups actually made them happy. Frère Bernard picked up his basket of blueberries, and they walked a few paces before he spoke again. He seemed to be choosing his words carefully.
"I was surprised to see someone else arrive. We all were. Including your boss, I think. Who was that man who flew in?"
"His name's Francois. He's the chief superintendent."
"Of the Sûreté?"
Beauvoir nodded.
"The big boss."
"Your pope," said Bernard.
"Only if the pope's a moron with a gun." Frère Bernard snorted, then fought to wipe the smile from his face.
"You don't like him?"
"Years of contemplation have sharpened your instincts, Frère Bernard."
Again Bernard laughed. "People come from miles around to hear my insights." Then his smile disappeared completely.
"For instance, this Francois, he doesn't like your boss, does he?"
This, too, they both knew, wasn't exactly an incredible feat of perception. Beauvoir wondered what to say. His impulse was always to lie. He'd have made, he thought, a good medieval architect. He immediately wanted to deny there was a problem, to cover the truth, to at the very least hide the scale of it. But he could see that would be useless. This man had seen clearly, as had everyone else, Francois's easy dismissal of Gamache on the dock. "It goes back a few years. They had a disagreement over a fellow officer." Frère Bernard didn't say anything. He simply listened, his face calm, his eyes noncommittal and attentive. They walked slowly through the forest, their feet crackling on the twigs and leaves fallen to the well-trodden path. The sun broke through the trees in patches, and every now and then they heard the scrambling of a chipmunk, or a bird, or some other wild creature. Beauvoir waited a moment, then went on. Might as well, he thought. It was all public knowledge anyway, unless you lived in a monastery in the middle of nowhere. What the monks knew and what everyone else knew seemed two very different things. The chief arrested one of the superintendents of the Sûreté, even though Francois and the others had ordered him not to. His name was Arnaud. He was actually the chief superintendent at the time. And now there was a small reaction on the monk's placid face, a tiny lifting of the brows, and then they settled back into place. It was almost invisible. Almost. Arrested him for what?
Murder. Sedition.
It came out that Arno was encouraging officers on reserves to kill any native who made trouble. Or at the very least, when a young native was shot or beaten to death, Arno didn't discipline the officers who did it. It was a short step from turning a blind eye to actively encouraging the killings. It became apparently, Beauvoir spoke haltingly, finding it difficult to talk about something so shameful, almost a sport. An elderly Cree woman asked Gamache for help finding her missing son. That's when he discovered what was going on. And the rest of the Sûreté leadership wanted your boss to stay quiet about it? Beauvoir nodded. They'd agreed to fire Arno and the other officers, but they didn't want a scandal, didn't want to lose the trust of the public. Frère Bernard didn't drop his eyes, but Beauvoir had the impression they wavered. Chief Inspector Gamache arrested Arno anyway, said Frère Bernard. He disobeyed orders. It never occurred to him not to. He thought the mothers and fathers and loved ones of those who were killed deserved an answer, and a public trial, and an apology. It all came out. It was a mess. Bernard nodded. The church knew from scandals, and knew from cover-ups, and knew from messes. What happened? The monk asked. Arno and the others were convicted. They're serving life sentences. And the chief inspector? Beauvoir smiled. He's still chief, but he'll never make superintendent, and he knows it. But he kept his job. They couldn't fire him. Even before this happened, he was one of the most respected officers in the Sûreté. The trial made him hated by the big bosses, but adored by the rank and file. He restored their pride, and, ironically, the public trust. François couldn't fire him, though he wanted to. He and Arno were friends, good friends. Frère Bernard thought about that for a moment. So did this François know what his friend was doing? They were both superintendents. The chief could never prove it. But he tried. He wanted to get all the rot out, said Beauvoir. And did he? I hope so. Both men thought back to that moment on the dock, Gamache's extended hand to help François from the plane, and François's look, a glance. There wasn't just enmity there, there was hatred. Why is the chief superintendent here? Asked Frère Bernard. I don't know. Beauvoir tried to keep his voice light, and it was the truth. He really didn't know. But again he felt the worry in his stomach roll over and scrape his insides. Frère Bernard frowned as he thought. Must be difficult for them to work together. Do they have to often? Not often. He'd go no further. He certainly wouldn't tell this monk about the last time Gamache and François had been thrown together on a case. The raid on the factory. Almost a year ago now, and the disastrous results. He saw again the chief gripping the sides of his desk and leaning toward François in a manner so threatening the chief superintendent had paled and stepped back. Beauvoir could count on one hand the number of times he'd heard Gamache yell, but he'd yelled that day, right into François's face. The ferocity of it had frightened even Beauvoir, and the chief superintendent had shouted back. Gamache had prevailed, but only by stepping back, by apologizing, by begging François to see reason. Gamache had begged. That was the price he'd paid, to get François to act. Beauvoir had never seen the chief beg before, but he'd done it that day. Gamache and François had barely spoken since. Perhaps a word at the state funeral for the officers killed in that raid on the factory, though Beauvoir doubted it. And maybe something at the ceremony when François had pinned a medal of bravery on Gamache's chest, against Gamache's wishes. But François had insisted, knowing that to the rest of the world it would appear he was rewarding the chief inspector. But the two men, privately, knew the truth. Beauvoir had been in the audience for that ceremony, had seen his chief's face when the medal had been placed on his chest. It might as well have pierced his heart. It was the right deed, for the wrong reason. Beauvoir knew his chief deserved that medal, but François had done it to humiliate. Publicly rewarding Gamache for an action that had left so many Sûreté agents dead and wounded. François had given it to him not as recognition for all the lives Gamache had saved that terrible day, but as an accusation, a permanent reminder, of all the young lives lost. Beauvoir could have killed Francoeur at that moment. Again he felt a clawing in the pit of his stomach. Something was trying to rip its way out. He wanted desperately to change the subject, to wipe away the memories of the ceremony, but mostly of that horrific day in the factory, when one of the lives lost had almost been his own, when one of the lives lost had almost been the chief's. Beauvoir thought about the tiny pills the size of wild blueberries, the ones still hidden in his apartment, and the burst they brought, not of musky flavour, but of blessed oblivion, numbing what hid in Beauvoir's secret room. He hadn't had an OxyContin or a Percocet in months, not since the chief had confronted him, taken the pills away, gotten him help. He might make a good Gilbertine after all. Like them, he lived in fear. Not of what would come at him from the outside, but what was patiently lying in wait inside his own walls. "Are you all right?" Beauvoir followed the soft voice back, like candies along a path, leading him out of the forest. "Can I help?" Frère Bernard had put out his rough hand and was touching Beauvoir's arm. "No, I'm fine. Just thinking about the case." The monk continued to examine his companion, far from convinced he was hearing the truth. Beauvoir scrambled around in his memory, picking up bits and pieces, desperate to find something useful. The case, the prior, the murder, the scene, the garden. "We were talking about the abbot's garden," said Beauvoir. His voice was gruff, not inviting any more confidences. He'd already gone too far. "Were we?" asked Frère Bernard. "You said everyone knows about it, but you haven't actually been in the garden yourself." "That's right." "Who had?" "Anyone Dom Philippe invited." Beauvoir realized he wasn't listening as closely as he should. He was still distracted by his memories and the feelings they awakened. Had there been resentment in Frère Bernard's voice just now? Beauvoir didn't think so, but with his attention frayed, he couldn't be sure. And again he cursed Francoeur for being where he wasn't wanted, in the monastery, and in Beauvoir's head, rattling around in there, poking awake things better left sleeping. He remembered what one of his counsellors had advised when he felt anxious. Breathe. Just breathe. Deep breath in, deep breath out. "What do you think of the abbot?" he asked. He was feeling light-headed. "What do you mean?" Beauvoir wasn't sure what he meant. "Deep breath in, deep breath out." "You're one of the abbot's men, aren't you?" he asked, grabbing at whatever question surfaced. "I am." "Why? Why not join with the prior?" The monk started kicking a stone, and Beauvoir focused on that as it danced and jumped.